going down, with other guys waiting next in line, right there, in the locality. "Tell me what happened, Finley," I said again. He leaned forward, cupped his mouth and nose with his hands, and sighed heavily into them. "Okay," he said. "It was pretty horrible. One of the worst I've ever seen. And I've seen a few, let me tell you. I've seen some pretty bad ones. But this was something else." He was naked. They nailed him to the wall. 6 or 7 big carpentry nails through his hands and up his arms, through the fleshy parts. They nailed his feet to the floor. Then they sliced his balls off. Just hacked them off. Blood everywhere. Pretty bad, let me tell you. Then they slit his throat, ear to ear. Bad people, Reacher. These are bad people. As bad as they come. I was numb. Finley was waiting for a comment. I couldn't think of anything. I was thinking about Charlie. She would ask if I had found anything out. Finley should go up there. He should go up there right now and break the news. It was his job, not mine. I could see why he was reluctant. Difficult news to break. Difficult details to gloss over. But it was his job. I'd go with him, because it was my fault. No point running away from that. "Yes," I said to him. "It sounds pretty bad." He leaned his head back and looked around, blew another sigh up at the ceiling, a somber man. "That's not the worst of it," he said. "You should have seen what they did to his wife." "His wife?" I said. "What the hell do you mean?" "I mean his wife," he said. "It was like a butcher's shop." For a moment, I couldn't speak. The world was spinning backward. "But I just saw her," I said. 20 minutes ago. She's okay. Nothing happened to her." "You saw who?" Finley said. "Charlie," I said. "Who the hell is Charlie?" he asked. "Charlie," I said blankly. "Charlie Hubble. His wife. She's okay. They didn't get her." "What's Hubble got to do with this?" he said. I just stared at him. "Who are we talking about?" I said. "Who got killed?" Finley looked at me like I was crazy. "I thought you knew," he said. "Chief Morrison, the chief of police, Morrison, and his wife." 12. I was watching Finley very carefully, trying to decide how far I should trust him. It was going to be a life or death decision. In the end, I figured his answer to one simple question would make up my mind for me. "Are they going to make you chief now?" I asked him. He shook his head. "No," he said. "They're not going to make me chief." "You sure about that?" I said. "I'm sure," he said. "Whose decision is it?" I asked him.
"The mayor's,"
Finley said.
"Town mayor," appoints the chief of police. "He's coming over. Guy named Teal. Some kind of an old Georgia family. Some ancestor was a railroad baron who owned everything in sight around here."
"Is that the guy you've got statues of?" I said. Finley nodded.
"Caspar Teal," he said.
"He was the first. They've had Teals here ever since. This mayor must be the great-grandson or something." I was in a minefield.
I needed to find a clear lane through. "What's the story with this guy Teal?" I asked him. Finlay shrugged, tried to find a way to explain it.
"He's just a southern asshole," he said. "Old George, her family, probably a long line of southern assholes. They beat the mayors around here since the beginning. I dare say this one's no worse than the others."
"Was he upset," I said, "when you called him about Morrison?"
"Worried, I think," Finlay said. "He hates mess."
"Why won't he make you chief?" I said. "You're the senior guy, right?"
"He just won't," Finlay said.
"Why not?
It's my business."
I watched him for a moment longer. "Life or death?" "Somewhere we can go to talk," I said. He looked over the desk at me.
"You thought it was Hubble got killed, right?" he said.
"Why?"
"Hubble did get killed," I said. "Fact that Morrison got killed as well doesn't change it."
We walked down to the convenience store, sat side by side at the empty counter near the window. I sat at the same place the pail Mrs. Kleiner had used when I was in there the day before. That seemed like a long time ago. The world had changed since then. We got tall mugs of coffee and a big plate of donuts. Didn't look at each other directly. We looked at each other in the mirror behind the counter.
"Why won't you get the promotion?" I asked him.
His reflection shrugged in the mirror. He was looking puzzled. He couldn't see the connection. But he'd see it soon enough.
"I should get it," he said. "I'm better qualified than all the others put together. I've done 20 years in a big city, a real police department. What the hell have they done? Look at Baker, for instance. He figures himself for a smart boy, but what has he done? 15 years in the sticks? In this backwater? What the hell does he know?"
"So why won't you get it?" I said.
"It's a personal matter," he said. "You think I'm going to sell it to the newspaper?" I asked him.
"It's a long story," he said. "So tell it to me," I said. "I need to know." He looked at me in the mirror, took a deep breath.
"I finished in Boston in March," he said. "Done my 20 years. Unblemished record. 8 commendations. I was one hell of a detective, Reacher. I had retirement on full pension to look forward to. But my wife was going crazy. Since last fall, she was getting agitated. It was so ironic. We were married all through those 20 years. I was working my ass off. Boston PD was a madhouse. We were working 7 days a week, all day and all night. All around me, guys were seeing their marriages fall apart. They were all getting divorced, one after the other." He stopped for a long pull on his coffee, took a bite of donut.
"But not me," he said.
"My wife could take it. Never complained. Never once. She was a miracle. Never gave me a hard time."
He lapsed back into silence. I thought about 20 years in Boston, working around the clock in that busy old city. Grimy 19th-century precincts, overloaded facilities, constant pressure, an endless parade of freaks, villains, politicians, problems. Finlay had done well to survive.
"It started last fall," he said again. "We were within 6 months of the end. It was all going to be over. We were thinking of a cabin somewhere, maybe. Vacations, plenty of time together, but she started panicking.
She didn't want plenty of time to gather. She didn't want me to retire. She didn't want me at home. She said she woke up to the fact that she didn't like me, didn't love me, didn't want me around. She had loved the 20 years, didn't want it to change. I couldn't believe it. It had been my dream, 20 years and then retire at 45. Then maybe another 20 years enjoying ourselves together before we got too old, you know? It was my dream, and I had worked toward it for 20 years. But she didn't want it. She ended up saying the thought of 20 more years with me in a cabin in the woods was making her flesh crawl. It got really bitter. We fell apart. I was a total basket case. He trailed off again. We got more coffee. It was a sad story. Stories about wrecked dreams always are. So obviously we got divorced, he said. Nothing else to do. She demanded it. It was terrible. I was totally out of it. Then, in my last month in the department, I started reading the union vacancy lists again. Saw this job, down here. I called an old buddy in Atlanta, FBI, and asked him about it. He warned me off. He said, forget it. He said it was a Mickey Mouse department in a town that wasn't even on the map. The job was called the Chief of Detectives, but there was only one detective. The previous guy was a weirdo who hung himself. The department was run by a fat moron. The town was run by some old Georgia type who couldn't remember slavery had been abolished. My friend up in Atlanta said, forget it. But I was so screwed up, I wanted it. I thought I could bury myself down here as a punishment. You know, a kind of penance. Also, I needed the money. They were offering top dollar, and I was looking at alimony and lawyer bills, you know. So I applied for it and came down. It was Mayor Teal and Morrison who saw me. I was a basket case, Reacher. I was a wreck. I couldn't string two words together. It had to be the worst job application in the history of the world. I must have come across as an idiot. But they gave me the job. I guess they needed a black guy to look good. I'm the first black cop in Margrave's history. I turned on the stool and looked straight at him. So you figure you're just a token? I said. That's why Teal won't make you chief. It's obvious, I guess, he said. He's got me marked down as a token and an idiot, not to be promoted further. Makes sense, in a way. Can't believe they gave me the job in the first place, token or not. I waved to the counter guy for the check. I was happy with Finley's story. He wasn't going to be chief, so I trusted him. And I trusted Roscoe. It was going to be the three of us against whoever. I shook my head at him in the mirror. You're wrong, I said. That's not the real reason. You're not going to be chief because you're not a criminal. I paid the check with a 10 and got all quarters for change. The guy still had no dollar bills. Then I told Finley I needed to see the Morrison place. Told him I needed all the details. He just shrugged and led me outside. We turned and walked south, passed by the village green, and put the town behind us. I was the first one there, he said, about 10 this morning. I hadn't seen Morrison since Friday, and I needed to update the guy, but I couldn't get him on the phone. It was middle of the morning on a Monday, and we hadn't done anything worth a damn about a double homicide from last Thursday night. We needed to get our asses in gear. So I went up to his house to start looking for him. He went quiet and walked on, revisiting in his mind the scene he had found. Front door was standing open, he said, maybe a half inch. It had a bad feel. I went in, found them upstairs in the master bedroom. It was like a butcher's shop. Blood everywhere. He was nailed to the wall, sort of hanging off. Both of them sliced up, him and his wife. It was terrible. About 24 hours of decomposition, warm weather, very unpleasant. So I called in the whole crew, and we went over every inch and pieced it all together. Literally, I'm afraid. He trailed off again, just went quiet. So it happened Sunday morning, I said. He nodded. Sunday papers on the kitchen table, he said. Couple of sections opened out and the rest untouched. Breakfast things on the table. Medical examiner says about 10 o'clock Sunday morning. Any physical evidence left behind? I asked him. He nodded again, grimly. Footprints in the blood, he said. The place was a lake of blood. Gallons of it. Partly dried up now, of course. They left footprints all over, but they were wearing rubber overshoes, you know, like you get for the winter up north. No chance of tracing them. They must sell millions every year. They had come prepared. They'd known there was going to be a lot of blood. They'd brought overshoes. They must have brought overalls, like the nylon bodysuits they wear in the slaughterhouse, on the killing floor. Big, white nylon suits, hooded, the white nylon splashed and smeared with bright red blood. They wore gloves, too, he said. There are rubbery smears in the blood on the walls. How many people? I asked him. I was trying to build up a picture. 4, he said. The footprints are confused, but I think I can see 4. I nodded. 4 sounded right. About the minimum, I reckoned. Morrison and his wife would have been fighting for their lives. It would take 4 of them at least. 4 out of the 10 Hubble had mentioned. Transport? I said. Can't really tell, Finley said. Gravel driveway, washed into ruts here and there. I saw some wide ruts which looked new. Maybe. Could have been wide tires. Maybe a big four-wheel drive or a small truck. We were a couple of 100 yards south of where Main Street had petered out. We turned west up a gravel driveway which must have been just about parallel with Beckman Drive. At the end of the driveway was Morrison's house. It was a big, formal place. White columns at the front, symmetrical evergreen trees dotted about. There was a new Lincoln parked near the door, and a lot of police tape strung at waist height between the columns. "We going in?" Finley asked. "May as well," I said. We ducked under the tape and pushed in through Morrison's front door. The house was a wreck. Gray, metallic fingerprint powder everywhere. Everything tossed and searched and photographed. You won't find anything, Finley said. We went over the whole place. I nodded and headed for the staircase, went up and found the master bedroom, stopped at the door and peered in. There was nothing to see except the ragged outline of the nail holes in the wall and the massive blood stains. The blood was turning black. It looked like somebody had flung buckets of tar around. The carpet was crusty with it. On the parquet in the doorway, I could see the footprints from the overshoes. I could make out the intricate pattern of the treads. I headed back downstairs and found Finley leaning on a porch column out front.
"Okay?" he asked me.
"Terrific," I said. "You searched the car?" He shook his head.
"That's Morrison's," he said. "We just looked for stuff the intruders might have left behind."
I stepped over to the Lincoln and tried the door. Unlocked. Inside, there was a strong new car smell and not much else. This was a chief's car. It wasn't going to be full of cheeseburger wrappings and soda cans like a patrolman's would be. But I checked it out. Poked around in the door pockets and under the seats, found nothing at all. Then I opened the glove box and found something. There was a switchblade in there. It was a handsome thing. Ebony handle with Morrison's name in gold-filled engraving. I popped the blade. Double-edged, 7 inches, Japanese surgical steel. Looked good. Brand new, never been used. I closed it up and slipped it into my pocket. I was unarmed and facing big trouble. Morrison's switchblade might make a difference. I slid out of the Lincoln and rejoined Finlay on the gravel.
"Find anything?" he asked.
"Nah," I said. "Let's go." We crunched back down the driveway together and turned north on the county road, headed back to town. I could see the church steeple and the bronze statue in the distance, waiting for us. 13. "Something I need to check with you," I said. Finley's patience was running thin. He looked at his watch.
"You better not be wasting my time, Reacher," he said.
We walked on north. The sun was dropping away from overhead, but the heat was still fierce. I didn't know how Finley could wear a tweed jacket and a moleskin vest. I led him over to the village green. We crossed the grass and leaned up on the statue of old Caspar Teal, side by side.
"They cut his balls off, right?" I said.
He nodded, looked at me, waiting.
"Okay," I said. "So the question is this. Did you find his balls?"
He shook his head.
"No," he said. "We went over the whole place. Ourselves and the medical examiner. They weren't there. His testicles are missing."
He smiled as he said it. He was recovering his cop's sense of humor.
"Okay," I said. "That's what I needed to know."
His smile widened, reached his eyes.
"Why?" he said. "Do you know where they are?"
"When's the autopsy?" I asked him. He was still smiling.
"His autopsy won't help," he said. "They were cut off. They're not connected to him anymore. They weren't there. They're missing. So how can they find them at his autopsy?"
"Not his autopsy," I said. "Her autopsy. His wife's. When they check what she ate." Finley stopped smiling, went quiet, just looked at me.
"Talk, Reacher," he said.
"Okay," I said. "That's why we came out here, remember? So answer another question for me. How many homicides have they had in Margrave?" He thought about it, shrugged.
"None," he said. "At least, not for maybe 30 years or so. Not since voter registration days, I guess."
"And now you've had 4 in 4 days, I said. "And pretty soon you'll find the fifth."
"Fifth?" he said.
"Who's the fifth?"
"Hubble," I said.
"My brother, the Sherman Staller guy, the 2 Morrisons, and Hubble makes 5. No homicides in 30 years, and now you've got 5 all at once. That can't be any kind of a coincidence, right?
No way, he said. Of course not.
They're linked.
Right, I said. Now I'll tell you some more links. But first of all, you got to understand something, right? I was just passing through here. On Friday and Saturday and Sunday, right up to the time those prints came through on my brother, I wasn't paying the slightest bit of attention to anything at all. I was just figuring I'd wait around and get the hell out of here as soon as possible.
So, he said. So I was told stuff, I said. Hubble told me things in Warburton, but I didn't pay a lot of attention. I wasn't interested in him, okay? He told me things, and I didn't follow them up with him, and I probably don't recall some of them.
Like, what things? Finlay said.
So I told him the things I remembered. I started the same way Hubble had started, trapped inside some kind of a racket, terrorized by a threat against himself and his wife, a threat consisting of the same things, word for word, that Finlay had just seen for himself that morning.
You sure about that? He said.
Exactly the same.
Word for word, I said.
Totally identical. Nailed to the wall, balls cut off, the wife forced to eat the balls, then they get their throats cut.
Word for word identical, Finlay. So unless we got two threateners at the same time in the same place, making the exact same threat, that's another link.
So Morrison was inside the same scam as Hubble, he said.
Owned and operated by the same people, I said.
Then I told him Hubble had been talking to an investigator, and I told him the investigator had been talking to Sherman Stoller, whoever he had been.
Who was the investigator? He asked.
And where does Joe fit in? Joe was the investigator, I said.
Hubble told me the tall guy with the shaved head was an investigator, trying to get him free.
What sort of an investigator was your brother? Finlay said.
Who the hell was he working for?
Don't know, I said. Last I heard, he was working for the Treasury Department.
Finlay pushed off the statue and started walking back north.
I gotta make some calls, he said. Time to go to work on this thing.
Walk slow, I said. I haven't finished yet.
Finlay was on the sidewalk. I was in the road, staying clear of the low awnings in front of every store. There was no traffic on the street to worry about. Monday, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the town was deserted.
How do you know Hubble's dead? Finlay asked me.
So I told him how I knew. He thought about it. He agreed with me.
Because he was talking to an investigator, he said.
I shook my head, stopped outside the barber shop.
No, I said. They didn't know about that. If they had, they'd have got to him much earlier. Thursday, at the latest.
I figured they made the decision to waste him Friday, about 5 o'clock. Because you pulled him in with the phone number in Joe's shoe, they figured he couldn't be allowed to talk to cops or prison guards, so they set it up with Spivey. But Spivey's boys blew it, so they tried over again. His wife said he got a call to wait at home today. They were setting him up for a second attempt. Looks like it worked.
Finlay nodded slowly.
Shit, he said.
He was the only link we had to exactly what the hell is going on here. You should have hit on him while you had the chance, Reacher.
Thanks, Finlay, I said. If I had known the dead guy was Joe, I'd have hit on him so hard you'd have heard him yelling all the way over here.
He just grunted. We moved over and sat together on the bench under the barbershop window.
I asked him what pluribus was, I said. He wouldn't answer. He said there were 10 local people involved in the scam, plus hired help in from the outside when necessary. And he said the scam is vulnerable until something happens on Sunday, exposed somehow. What happens on Sunday? Finlay asked. He didn't tell me, I said. And you didn't press him? He asked. I wasn't very interested, I said. I told you that. And he gave you no idea what the scam is all about? He asked. No idea, I said. Did he say who these 10 people are? He asked. No, I said. Christ, Reacher, you're a big help, you know that? He said. I'm sorry, Finlay, I said. I thought Hubble was just some asshole. If I could go back and do it again, I'd do it a lot different, believe me. 10 people, he said again. Not counting himself, I said. Not counting Sherman Stoller, either. But I assume he was counting Chief Morrison. Great, Finlay said. That only leaves me another 9 to find. You'll find one of them today, I said. The black pickup I had last seen leaving Eno's parking lot pulled up short at the opposite curb. It waited there, motor running. The Kleiner kid leaned his head on his forearm and stared out of the window at me from across the street. Finlay didn't see him. He was looking down at the sidewalk. You should be thinking about Morrison, I said to him. What about him? He said. He's dead, right? But dead how? I said. What should that be saying to you? He shrugged. Somebody making an example of him, he said. A message? Correct, Finlay, I said. But what had he done wrong? Screwed something up, I guess, he said. Correct, Finlay, I said again. He was told to cover up what went down at the warehouse Thursday night. That was his task for the day. He was up there at midnight, you know. He was? Finlay said. You said that was a bullshit story. No, I said. He didn't see me up there. That part was the bullshit story. But he was up there himself. He saw Joe. He did, Finlay said. How do you know that? First time he saw me was Friday, right? I said. In the office? He was staring at me like he had seen me before, but he couldn't place where. That was because he had seen Joe. He noticed a resemblance. Hubble said the same thing. He said, I reminded him of his investigator. So Morrison was there, Finlay said. Was he the shooter? Can't figure it that way, I said. Joe was a reasonably smart guy. He wouldn't let a fat idiot like Morrison shoot him. The shooter must have been somebody else. I can't figure Morrison for the maniac, either. That much physical exertion would have dropped him with a heart attack. I think he was the third guy, the cleanup guy. But he didn't search Joe's shoes, and because of that, Hubble got hauled in. That got somebody mad. It meant they had to waste Hubble, so Morrison was wasted as a punishment. Some punishment, Finlay said. Also a message, I said. So think about it. Think about what? He said. Wasn't a message for me. So who was it a message for? I said. Who was any such message for? He said. The next guy in line, right? I nodded. See why I was worried who was going to be the next chief? I said. Finlay dropped his head again and stared at the sidewalk. Christ, he said. You think the next chief will be in this scam?
Got to be, I said. Why would they have Morrison inside? Not for his wonderful personality, right?
They had him inside because they need the chief on board, because that's useful to them in some particular way. So they wouldn't waste Morrison unless they had a replacement ready. And whoever it is, we're looking at a very dangerous guy. He'll be going in there with Morrison's example, staring him in the face. Somebody will have just whispered to him, "See what we did to Morrison? That's what we'll do to you if you screw up the way he did."
"So who is it?" Finlay said. "Who's going to be the new chief?"
"That's what I was asking you," I said. We sat quiet on the bench outside the barber shop for a moment, enjoyed the sun creeping in under the edge of the striped awning. "It's you, me, and Roscoe," I said. "Right now, the only safe thing is to assume everybody else is involved."
"Why Roscoe?" he said.
"Lots of reasons," I said, "but mainly because she worked hard to get me out of Warburton. Morrison wanted me in there as a fall guy for Thursday night, right? So if Roscoe was inside the scam, she'd have left me in there. But she got me out. She pulled in the exact opposite direction from Morrison. So if he was bent, she isn't." He looked at me, grunted.
"Only three of us?" he said.
"You're a cautious guy, Reacher." "You bet your ass I'm a cautious guy, Finlay," I said. "People are getting killed here. One of them was my only brother." We stood up from the bench on the sidewalk. Across the street, the Kleiner kid killed his motor and got out of the pickup, started walking slowly over. Finlay rubbed his face with his hands like he was washing without water.
"So, what now?" he said.
"You got things to do," I said. "You need to get Roscoe on one side and fill her in with the details, okay? Tell her to take a lot of care. Then you need to make some calls and find out from Washington what Joe was doing down here."
"Okay," Finlay said. "What about you?"
I nodded across at the Kleiner kid. "I'm going to have a talk with this guy," I said. "He keeps looking at me." Two things happened as the Kleiner kid came near. First, Finlay left in a hurry. He just strode off north without another word. Second, I heard the barbershop blinds coming down in the window behind me. I glanced around. There could have been nobody else on the planet except for me and the Kleiner kid. Up close, the kid was an interesting study. He was no lightweight, probably 6'2", maybe 190, shot through with some kind of a restless energy. There was a lot of intelligence in his eyes, but there was also some kind of an eerie light burning in there. His eyes told me this probably wasn't the most rational character I was ever going to meet in my whole life. He came close and stood in front of me, just stared at me.
"You're trespassing," he said.
"This is your sidewalk?" I said.
"It sure is," the kid said. "My daddy's foundation paid for every inch of it, every brick. But I'm not talking about the sidewalk. I'm talking about Miss Roscoe. She's mine. She's mine right from when I first saw her. She's waiting for me. 5 years she's been waiting for me until the time is right." I gazed back at him.
"You understand English?" I said. The kid tensed up. He was just about hopping from foot to foot.
"I'm a reasonable guy," I said. "First time Miss Roscoe tells me she wants you instead of me, I'm out of here. Until then, you back off. Understand that?" The kid was boiling, but then he changed. It was like he was
operated by a remote control, and somebody had just hit a button and switched the channel. He relaxed and shrugged and smiled a wide, boyish smile.
"Okay," he said. "No hard feelings, right?"
He stuck out his hand to shake on it, and he nearly fooled me. Right at the last split second, I pulled my own hand back a fraction and closed around his knuckles, not his palm. It's an old army trick. They go to shake your hand, but they're aiming to crush it. Some big macho ritual. The way out is to be ready. You pull back a fraction, and you squeeze back. You're squeezing their knuckles, not the meat of their palm. Their grip is neutralized. If you catch it right, you can't lose. He started crushing, but he never stood a chance. He was going for the steady squeeze so he could stare into my eyes while I sweated it out. But he never got near. I crunched his knuckles once, then twice a little harder, and then I dropped his hand and turned away. I was a good 60 yards north before I heard the truck start up. It rumbled south, and its noise was lost in the buzz of the heat. 14. Back at the station house, there was a big white Cadillac parked right across the entrance. Brand new, fully loaded, full of puffy black leather and fake wood. It looked like a Vegas whorehouse after the stern walnut and old hide in Charlie Hubbell's Bentley. Took me 5 strides to get around its hood to the door. Inside in the chill, everybody was milling around a tall old guy with silver hair. He was in an old-fashioned suit, boot-lace tie with a silver clasp. Looked like a real asshole. Some kind of a politician. The Cadillac driver. He must have been about 75 years old, and he was limping around, leaning on a thick cane with a huge silver knob at the top. I guessed this was Mayor Teal. Roscoe was coming out of the big office and back. She had been pretty shaken up after being at the Morrison place. Wasn't looking too good now, but she waved and tried a smile. Gestured me over. Wanted me to go into the office with her. I took another quick glance at Mayor Teal and walked over to her. "You okay?" I said.
"I've had better days," she said.
"You up to speed?" I asked her. "Finley gave you the spread?" She nodded.
"Finley told me everything," she said.
We ducked into the big rosewood office. Finley was sitting at the desk under the old clock. It showed 4:15. Roscoe closed the door, and I looked back and forth between the two of them. "So who's getting it?" I said. "Who's the new chief?" Finley looked up at me from where he was sitting, shook his head.
"Nobody," he said. "Mayor Teal is going to run the department himself."
I went back to the door and cracked it open an inch, peered out and looked at Teal across the squad room. He had Baker pinned up against the wall. Looked like he was giving him a hard time about something. I watched him for a moment.
"So what do you make of that?" I asked them.
"Everybody else in the department is clean,"
Roscoe said.
"Looks that way, I guess," I said.
"But it proves Teal himself is on board. Teal's their replacement, so Teal's their boy."
"How do we know he's just their boy?" she said. "Maybe he's the big boss. Maybe he's running the whole thing."
"Nah," I said. The big boss had Morrison carved up as a message. If Teal was the big boss, why would he send a message to himself? He belongs to somebody. He's been put in here to run interference.
"That's for sure," Finley said. "Started already. Told us Joe and Stala are going on the back burner. We're throwing everything at the Morrison thing. Doing it ourselves. No outside help, no FBI, no nothing. He says
The pride of the department is at stake, and he's already driving us up a blind alley. Says it's obvious Morrison was killed by somebody just out of prison. Somebody Morrison himself put away a long time ago. Out for revenge.
And it's a hell of a blind alley, Roscoe said. We've got to trawl through 20 years of old files and cross-check every name in every file against parole records from across the entire country. It could take us months. He's pulled Stevenson in off the road for it. Until this is over, he drives a desk. So do I.
It's worse than a blind alley, Finley said. It's a coded warning. Nobody in our files looks good for violent revenge. Never had that sort of crime here. We know that. And Teal knows we know that. But we can't call his bluff, right?
Can't you just ignore him? I said. Just do what needs doing.
He leaned back in his chair, blew a sigh at the ceiling, and shook his head.
No, he said. We're working right under the enemy's nose. Right now, Teal's got no reason to think we know anything about any of this, and we've got to keep it that way. We've got to play dumb and act innocent, right? That's going to limit our scope. But the big problem is authorization. If I need a warrant or something, I'm going to need his signature. And I'm not going to get it, am I?
I shrugged at him.
I'm not planning on using warrants, I said. Did you call Washington?
They're getting back to me, he said.
Just hope Teal doesn't grab the phone before I can.
I nodded.
What you need is somewhere else to work, I said. What about that buddy of yours up in Atlanta, FBI, the one you told me about? Could you use his office as a kind of private facility?
Finley thought about it, nodded.
Not a bad idea, he said. I'll have to go off the record. I can't ask Teal to make a formal request, right? I'll call from home tonight. A guy called Picard. Nice guy. You'll like him. He's from the Quarter down in New Orleans. He did a spell in Boston about 1 million years ago. Great big guy. Very smart. Very tough.
Tell him we need it kept very quiet, I said. We don't want his agents down here until we're ready.
What are you going to do about Teal?
Roscoe asked me.
He works for the guys who killed your brother.
I shrugged again.
Depends how involved he was, I said. He wasn't the shooter.
He wasn't?
Roscoe said.
How do you know that?
Not fast enough, I said. Limps around with a cane in his hand. Too slow to pull a gun. Too slow to get Joe anyway. He wasn't the kicker either. Too old, not vigorous enough. And he wasn't the gopher. That was Morrison. But if he starts messing with me, then he's in deep shit. Otherwise, to hell with him.
So what now?
She said. I shrugged at her, didn't reply.
I think Sunday is the thing, Finley said. Sunday is going to solve some kind of a problem for them. Teal being put in here feels so temporary, you know? The guy's 75 years old. He's got no police experience. It's a temporary fix to get them through until Sunday.
The buzzer on the desk went off. Stevenson's voice came over the intercom, asking for Roscoe. They had files to check. I opened the door for her, but she stopped. She'd just thought of something.
What about Spivey?
She said.
Over at Warburton. He was ordered to arrange the attack on Hubble, right? So he must know who gave him the order. You should go ask him. Might lead somewhere.
Maybe, I said. Closed the door behind her.
Waste of time, Finley said to me. You think Spivey's just going to tell you a thing like that?
I smiled at him.
If he knows, he'll tell me, I said to him. A question like that, it's how you ask it, right? Take care, Reacher, he said. They see you getting close to what Hubble knew, they'll waste you like they wasted him. Charlie and her kids flashed into my mind, and I shivered. They would figure Charlie was close to what Hubble had known. That was inevitable. Maybe even his kids as well. A cautious person would assume kids could have overheard something. It was 4 o'clock. The kids would be out of school. There were people out there who had loaded up with rubber overshoes, nylon bodysuits and surgical gloves, and sharp knives, and a bag of nails, and a hammer. Finley, call your buddy Picard right now, I said. We need his help. We've got to put Charlie Hubble somewhere safe, and her kids, right now. Finley nodded gravely. He saw it. He understood. For sure, he said. Get your ass up to Beckman. Right now. Stay there. I'll organize Picard. You don't leave until he shows up, okay? He picked up the phone, dialed an Atlanta number from memory. Roscoe was back at her desk. Mayor Teal was handing her a thick wad of file folders. I stepped over to her and pulled up a spare chair, sat down next to her. What time do you finish? I said.
About 6, I guess, she said.
Bring some handcuffs home. Okay, I said.
You're a fool, Jack Reacher, she said.
Teal was watching, so I got up and kissed her hair, went out into the afternoon and headed for the Bentley. The sun was dropping away and the heat was gone. Shadows were lengthening up. Felt like the fall was on its way. Behind me I heard a shout. Mayor Teal had followed me out of the building. He called me back. I stayed where I was, made him come to me. He limped over, tapping his cane, smiling. Stuck out his hand and introduced himself. Said his name was Grover Teal. He had that politician's knack of fixing you with a look and a smile like a searchlight, like he was thrilled to bits just to be talking to me.
Glad I caught you, he said. Sergeant Baker has brought me up to date on the warehouse homicides. It all seems pretty clear to me. We made a clumsy mistake in apprehending you, and we're all very sorry indeed about your brother, and we'll certainly let you know just as soon as we get to any conclusions. So, before you get on your way, I'd be grateful if you'd kindly accept my apology on behalf of this department. I wouldn't want you to take away a bad impression of us. May we just call it a mistake?
Okay, Teal, I said. But why do you assume I'm leaving? He came back smoothly, not more than a tiny hesitation.
I understood you were just passing through, he said. We have no hotel here in Margrave, and I imagined you would find no opportunity to stay.
I'm staying, I said. I received a generous offer of hospitality. I understand that's what the South is famous for, right? Hospitality? He beamed at me and grasped his embroidered lapel.
Oh, undoubtedly that's true, sir, he said. The South as a whole, and Georgia in particular, is indeed famous for the warmth of its welcome. However, as you know, just at the present time, we find ourselves in a most awkward predicament. In the circumstances, a motel in Atlanta or Macon would really suit you much better. Naturally, we would keep in close touch, and we would extend you every assistance in arranging your brother's funeral when that sad time comes.
comes. Here in Margrave, I'm afraid, we're all going to be very busy. It'll be boring for you. Officer Roscoe's going to have a lot of work to do. She shouldn't be distracted just at the moment, don't you think?
I won't distract her, I said evenly. I know she's doing vital work.
He looked at me, an expressionless gaze, eye to eye, but he wasn't really tall enough. He'd get a crick in his scrawny old neck. And if he kept on staring at me like that, he'd get his scrawny old neck broken. I gave him a wintry smile and stepped away to the Bentley, unlocked it, then got in, gunned the big motor and whirred the window down.
See you later, Teal, I called as I drove away.
The end of the school day was the busiest I'd ever seen the town. I passed two people on Main Street and saw another four in a knot near the church. Some kind of an afternoon club, maybe. Reading the Bible, or bottling peaches for the winter. I drove past them and hustled the big car up the sumptuous mile of Beckman Drive, turned in at the Hubbles' white mailbox, and spun the old Bakelite steering wheel through the driveway curves. The problem with trying to warn Charlie was I didn't know how much I wanted to tell her. Certainly, I wasn't about to give her the details. Didn't even feel right to tell her Hubble was dead at all. We were stuck in some kind of a limbo, but I couldn't keep her in the dark forever. She needed to know some context, or else she wouldn't listen to the warning. I parked her car at her door and rang her bell. The children dashed around from somewhere as Charlie opened up and let me in. She was looking pretty tired and strained. The children looked happy enough. They hadn't picked up on their mother's worries. She chased them off, and I followed her back to the kitchen. It was a big, modern room. I got her to make me some coffee. I could see she was anxious to talk, but she was having trouble getting started. I watched her fiddling with the filter machine.
"Don't you have a maid?"
I asked her. She shook her head.
I don't want one, she said. I like to do things myself.
It's a big house, I said.
I like to keep busy, I guess, she said.
Then we were silent. Charlie switched on the coffee machine, and it started with a faint hiss. I sat at a table in a window nook that overlooked an acre of velvet lawn. She came and sat opposite me, folded her hands in front of her.
I heard about the Morrisons, she said at last. Is my husband involved in all of this?
I tried to think exactly what I could say to her. She waited for an answer. The coffee machine burbled away in the big silent kitchen.
Yes, Charlie, I said. I'm afraid he was. But he didn't want to be involved, okay? Some kind of blackmail was going on.
She took it well. She must have figured it out for herself, anyway. Must have run every possible speculation through her head. This explanation was the one which fit. That was why she didn't look surprised or outraged. She just nodded. Then she relaxed. She looked like it had done her good to hear someone else say it. Now it was out in the open. It was acknowledged. It could be dealt with.
I'm afraid that makes sense, she said.
She got up to pour the coffee, kept talking as she went.
That's the only way I can explain his behavior, she said. Is he in danger?
Charlie, I'm afraid I have no idea where he is, I said.
She handed me a mug of coffee, sat down again on the kitchen counter.
Is he in danger?
She asked again.
I couldn't answer. Couldn't get any words out.
She moved off the counter and came to sit
opposite me again at the table in the window. She cradled her cup in front of her. She was a fine-looking woman, blonde and pretty, perfect.